Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 5th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is the presenter, Rebecca Lucky. Today's session number is 98-3, and it is titled Women of Genesis, The Next Generation. Let's listen in.
Welcome once again. I'm glad to see you here. If you're at Holden for more than 2 days, you know that you hear things repeated again and again because some of you haven't been here every day. So my name is Rebecca Lucky, and we're looking at the women of Genesis. And yesterday we finished, well, we're not ever really finishing any of these stories, but we looked at the story that included Hagar. And then today we're going to move on to the next generation, which is the story of Rebecca. So I want to say just a couple of things to get us started. First I'll ask, any other thoughts, questions, insights that you had on the Hagar story as you were, I'm sure, meditating on it all yesterday afternoon and evening? I heard a lot of good conversation after our discussion yesterday and all kinds of points that just made me feel like my work was done. The insights were so helpful and so good. Today, as we move on, our list is going to continue to grow here. Some of the tools that we have found valuable for reading scripture, the text, and I added in its context, which is actually probably what I'm trying to say even more than text, is that one of the real tools, I think, for reading and interpreting and understanding and living with these stories is trying to get them as much in their context as possible. So that's what we're doing. That's why we're not doing a lot of just verse here, verse there, skip here, skip there. Those of you who are in a church and that church has a lectionary tradition where the readings are chosen, and assigned to the Sundays, you know, you'll get a lot of pay attention to where there's big gaps that have been cut out, especially if you have any inserts in your bulletins where you can see, oh, we read verses 1 through 5, we skip 6, 7, and 8, and then we pick up in 9. Right away, my question is, ooh, what's 6, 7, and 8? There's a lot of decisions, a lot that goes into the decision of what to include in those readings and what not to include. A lot of it I beg to differ with. I think sometimes the best things are not included. Not the best things, but the most interesting things. So one of the real tools that we've been working with is trying to keep the text in its context. And that goes for, we're reading narrative right now, a style that's narrative, that's story. Not all of the Bible is in that style. But then if we were reading, say, the Psalms, to try to keep the entire psalm together or the entire poem together, I think is really helpful. And then we talked about imagination. And then a community of readers we touched on yesterday, that there is no special award given to you in heaven if you've done a lot of reading of the Bible on your own. And that's wonderful if that is what works for you devotionally, if that's what works for you to grow in understanding or faith. But it certainly is not the only way or the best way. I'm not sure there's a best way. But the conversations that we get to have here with one another and the insights, I think, are invaluable to reading scripture. So, and then I just added that a community of readers, a faith community of readers, or a community that doesn't necessarily identify itself as a faith community. That's enough, you know, or one that's mixed. How many of you saw the Genesis series on, I can't say Channel 9, I can say PBS. Yeah, with Bill Moyers. Those were fascinating. I don't know if you found them. People either found them fascinating or boring. I thought they were fascinating because he put together this group of 5 or 6 readers, some from the faith tradition, some not from a tradition of faith, some from the Jewish tradition, some from the Christian tradition, and just they sat in kind of a semicircle and hashed over these stories. And I just loved it. It was a wonderful conversation.
A nephew of mine happened to know Bill Moyer and sent me a signed copy
of the book. Oh, neat.
And the interesting thing is, when I read it, I didn't get the same feeling from it as I did in a community of people.
Isn't that interesting?
You need the voice change, the inflection, the
facial expression,
emotion, and everything to make it that as powerful as it was.
Yeah, they are available on tape too, on videotape.
Oh, I didn't.
Which, if you ever get the chance and are interested, sometimes it comes over PBS. They advertise them, probably not until they're showing the series again. In Seattle, there's a Channel 9 store, which is the public television store, and I don't know if any of you live in areas that have those kinds of stores, or they have a catalog too that you could order like Wobegon tapes out of, and also these Bill Moyers Genesis tapes. So that's kind of that tradition. It has its roots in the rabbinic tradition of Midrash, where the rabbis would sit and debate and discuss and then record these things that are a wonderful part of Jewish tradition that has not crossed over as much into Christian tradition. As we start reading Rebecca today, let's think about this idea of covenant, because we're starting to see this take on now more social ramifications. We saw the covenant be set, if any of you read on the Genesis 17, is where the very specific covenant language with Abraham is. A fairly familiar passage to any of you who have read the book of Genesis or attend church regularly. This one comes up quite often. We saw a covenant made with Adam and Eve. We've seen one made with Noah, and now with Abraham and Sarah and their family. The next big one in classic Old Testament studies will be the one that's made with Moses, the Mosaic Covenant. Covenant language is fairly specific. There are, of course, millions of people who've gotten their PhD in covenant language, so if you ever want to read up on that, there's plenty of material. But this understanding of a specific relationship that's established, it often has a sign that goes with it. We think of the rainbow as being the sign of the covenant God makes with Noah. Circumcision is the sign of the covenant God makes with Abraham. That's an interesting sign of a covenant when it clearly that sign is only applicable to one gender, isn't it? And that's just an interesting point when you look at that. And of course, the women came into that covenant. It's not that they weren't included, but they were so definitely included through the man. Primogenitor laws. If you read Deuteronomy 21:16 through 18, you see the law that the firstborn son has special access to the family property, to the family name, to the family blessing. Let's start watching now, though, because God is up to something here. Did Ishmael, was he the one that ended up with the... Ishmael was the firstborn son, wasn't he? Is he the one that ended up the carrier of the covenant? Esau is the firstborn son of Isaac and Rebekah. Is he the one who ends up carrying the covenant? No. So God's up to something here, I'm convinced. And it's one of those ironic, humorous sorts of ways, I think, that we see God working. God is not bound by human law, is God. And oftentimes, I listened to a lecture one time by this man from Ireland, and he had this great brogue, and he kept talking about how subversive God is. And we see God sort of being subversive when it comes to this law, don't we? You might think that's how it works, but I'm up to something else here. And truly, I think we see, I link it to the understanding of vocation, that that there are those who God has called to this role of receiving, handing down of the covenant. That's their vocation. And that vocation isn't necessarily assigned by birth order. It's assigned, what we'll see now as we read the stories, I'm not even sure it's assigned by character. I mean, you'd think that God may recognize a certain character or create a certain character in a person and then call forth that vocation. I don't know about that. We talked about how Abraham's character certainly was in rough form at the beginning and then got shaped by God as the story went on. Jacob, well, that's all I'll say about him. You'll have to read about him. So, and then this will start taking shape as we go. The receiving and handing down is the covenant of the covenant as the primary purpose for these people being. And not just the Jacobs and the Isaacs and the Abrahams, but everybody in the story. And that helps us, if we keep that in our mind, understand some of the characters' behavior. That their job now, their calling, is to take this extremely fragile covenant, in their mind, fragile given that they live in the midst of people who are not part of this covenant, and how is this covenant going to be passed on? That still is a huge question in the mind of the Jews now. What is assimilation, and how do you preserve a covenant, and where is God's hand in all of that? So let's keep those in mind as we launch into the reading of Rebecca. When you think of Rebecca, what do you think of? What do you know? What do you know for sure? Or what do you know not for sure? What do you think you might know maybe?
Isaac saw her at the well.
Okay, she was seen at the well. Uh-huh. What else? Anything? She's not as well known as Sarah, is she? Probably not even as well known as Rachel. Yeah. So you have no real preconceptions of Rebecca when you come to this. That's interesting. Usually what people remember is that she helped scam the covenant. Scam the blessing.
I think she was, I see her as an active person. Mm-hmm. She has a mind what she wants, and she gives up when she gets it. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, the men are kind of passive in this story. She's the one that...
Yeah, look for that in this story as we read today. Even the language that's used about Rebecca, and I'll point out some of the things that the people in the early study noticed that I hadn't even noticed. And Isaac, interestingly enough, Isaac is a fairly passive character. Now, not entirely passive, but he's, Abraham and Jacob are kind of these larger-than-life characters. And then there's Isaac, that we don't know as much about, but think of the stories that we do know tend to be ones where, he's lying on an altar, right, from when he's a boy, or the story where he's duped about his sons. He has seen a woman had a wonderful comment this morning about how those are qualities, the fact that Isaac is seen meditating out in the field and sharing, the choosing of, sharing some of the things that he shares with his family, not just ruling so autocratically, that those are things we may value now in husbands and in fathers. But the fact that he was less of a macho kind of character may mean that he got less time and space in these stories. I thought that was kind of an interesting comment. That those qualities weren't as valued in his time as they might be now.
So. I mean, I think another interesting thing, right, because I read this morning, I did my homework.
Good for you, you get points.
But I think in comparing Rebecca with, like Jacob as a schemer and Abraham, they definitely, weren't always honest about things and tried to, get the best any way they could. I think it's easy, and I don't know if it's kind of a sexist view, but, some people look at Rebecca, and see her as the bad guy or as the schemer. And I kind of, and this just kind of popped in my head this morning, I'm a real fan of Gone with the Wind, and Scarlett O'Hara has always been one of my, and I'm from Georgia, so.
Oh, there you go.
But, she was a real schemer, too, and trying to you know, work things out and making plans and you're doing.
So you're saying you kind of are drawn to those characters?
Well, I think there's a certain cleverness and a certain ingenuity and and you know, these Genesis stories, you know, that's used. You know, Jacob is used that way, and then later on, he and Laban kind of
speak
against each other.
Right.
It kind of makes it interesting.
Yeah, it does make it interesting.
It's human nature.
Yeah, what do you learn about human beings? Yeah.
Here's an example of a woman doing the same thing.
Well, and that shrewdness or bordering on deceit, cunning, could be something, could be a vessel used by God. It's something we don't often think about, is it? But it's undeniable in Jacob. And when we read Rebecca today, know that the tradition has often interpreted her as deceitful and a one-dimensional character, and I don't think she's a one-dimensional character at all. So let's read her before we say more so that everybody can get in on the conversation. Would you mind shutting those doors for me? Thank you. Let's open up to chapter 24. We're going to be covering a lot of turf here because there are a lot of details included in this story, which is wonderful. Makes it a little hard to get it into an hour, but does somebody want to read 1 through 9 for us? Chapter 24, 1 through 9.
Now Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his house, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I live, but will go to my country, to my kindred, and get a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came? Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter.
Okay. What do you notice? Details that seem interesting or strange, or
they have an interesting way of making agreements.
Yeah. Anybody have a hunch about that?
Well, isn't that essentially the line that, you know, you're swearing by your descendants?
Exactly. Have any of you ever known of the relationship between the word testament and testicle? They're related. Fertility was the ultimate value, wasn't it? And so, no, that's what it was. I mean, we get that hand under the thigh thing, and there's only one place for that line to go. This is how they took oaths. That's all I'll say. Just be happy that all we have to do is sign papers now. Anything else in that? This servant possibly is Eliezer, the servant that we meet in Genesis 15, who's Abraham's man Friday. So he's setting off now. He wants him to go. Why do you think he wants him to go back to their family land as opposed to having Isaac marry a Canaanite woman?
I think because the faith was still more pure there.
Yeah, the threat, you know, this receiving the covenant, handing down the covenant. Now, Rebecca and Abraham's family wouldn't be what we classically understand as Jewish, but they are Abraham's family, and so they can be brought in to this. So he is saying, go and get someone that is from our family, as opposed to Isaac marrying somebody who is pagan. And we'll see that same thing with the twins too.
Abraham seems much further along in his relationship with God.
Isn't that, yeah.
To use some of the language that another one was talking about in terms of his faith development. And he keeps drawing in, like, the promise that he made with God. And
his faith matured.
Stay true to it. He was very decided that he was going to do that.
Yeah. And isn't that hopeful? I mean, the comments that we've heard in our studies about, oh, I read these stories, and one thing that, the one way I experience God is as very patient. You know, that is so hopeful. That is some good news that comes from these texts, is you see these characters in their rough form, and then they live out their lives in this life of faith, and they're shaped, and they're refined, and they're, like a gold nugget, to use our context here. Refiner's fire burns off the stuff, the chaff, and somehow we see Abraham here, and he seems a much more mature character.
Yeah, right before his death.
Right before his death, yeah. I don't know, I think for most of it probably happened after he died, but... yes, Abraham in 23 bought a piece of land to bury Sarah, and that's the first piece of land that this family owns in Canaan. It's at Hebron. Does that ring a bell to anyone? Hebron has been a site of all kinds of bloodshed throughout the years. This is where many of these forefathers and foremothers are buried, with the exception of Rachel. So Sarah has died. That may be part of Abraham's approved sort of wisdom and experience and all of that. So, okay, 10. Oh, question? Can I blow over somebody? 10 through 14. Let's read it clear through 21. 10 through 21.
Like a children's devotional.
Go ahead. I think different. Let me say something about that. One of the things when you're reading scripture in community that's really adds depth to it is to have different translations.
I don't know if it's the new revised.
NIV.
Is it the new international reading? Yeah.
Yeah. So listen, look at yours, and see where some of those differences are. Is oftentimes where you find really interesting. It casts a different light on a word that you hadn't heard that way. So
the servant took 10 of his master's camels and left. He took with him all kinds of good things from his master. He started out from Aram Naharam. He made his way to the town of Nahor. He stopped near the well outside the town. There he made the camels get down on their knees. It was almost evening. It was the time when women go out to get water. Then he prayed, "Lord, you are the God of my master Abraham. Give me success today. Be kind to my master Abraham. I'm standing beside this spring. The daughters of the people who live in the town are coming out here to get water. I will speak to a young woman. I'll say, 'Please lower your jar so I can have a drink.' Suppose she says, 'Have a drink of water and I'll get some for your camels too.' Then let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. That's how I'll know you have been kind to my master." Before he had finished praying, Rebecca came out. She had a jar on her shoulder. She was the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah. Milcah was the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. The young woman was very beautiful. She was a virgin. No man had ever had sex with her. She went down to the spring. She filled her jar and came up again. The servant hurried to meet her. He said, "Please give me a little water from your jar." "Have a drink, sir," she said. She quickly lowered the jar to her hands, and she gave him a drink. After she had given him a drink, she said, "I'll get water for your camels, too. I'll keep doing it until they finish drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the stone tub. Then she ran back to the well to get more water. She got enough for all his camels. The man didn't say a word. He watched her closely. He wanted to learn whether the Lord had given him success on the journey he had made.
Okay. Is that a familiar story to you, or this meeting? Yeah, what do you notice? What seems interesting to you, or confusing, or...
Well, she's somehow related to Abraham.
Yeah, she is. Mm-hmm. Somebody figured that out this morning, that she's a... Unless she's second cousin twice removed, or I don't know what it is, but yeah, she's related. She's in the family. They're all related at this point.
It's an awful lot of work to get water for all those camels.
Yeah, so she's willing. The quality of hospitality, maybe, that she has, was highly valued at that time, perhaps even more than we value it now. I mean, I would say definitely more than we value it now.
Jumped out at me that we're told twice she was a virgin.
Yeah.
Just in two different sets of language.
What do you make of that?
That was very important.
Yeah, yeah. Made her more valuable.
Well, would she have had some sort of a hat or headpiece or something? I mean, was
it
that
would have indicated that
visibly apparent?
That's an interesting question, whether that's something that Eliezer could tell at that point. I don't know. I mean, gosh, how well, maybe there was a huge press release like when Diana. I mean, yeah, right. I don't know how he knew, but we know. That's an interesting question. That would be a question of custom.
Well, maybe he didn't know. Maybe we're being told
maybe
that.
We're just
and that's why he's continuing to watch to learn more about her.
To see if she does some unvirgin-like thing. I don't know what that would be. Does she draw water from a different side of the well? What else do you notice? This text, this whole story, part of the story makes me laugh because do you notice his prayer? The servant's prayer reminds me of the famous style of praying I call the announcement prayer. Dear God, please bless the bazaar we're having on Saturday at 10 a.m. Everybody whose name ends in A, bring a dish. Don't you love those kinds of prayers where basically you're just making an announcement? But the way he tells God what's going to happen. Here I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. You know, like God didn't see that, you know. And then tells God, God, this is how it's going to work. Let the girl say this, and then I'll say this. I just think that's an interesting prayer that's there. It kind of gives me hope for the prayers that we lift up to God.
Well, it seems to me it's an awful big responsibility to give to a mere servant. We don't know anything about the servant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this story we don't, do we?
No, and we only have the words of the prayer to describe what the servant was like.
Yeah, yeah. But what we do know from reading this, even though it's not stated, is that he was a trusted servant.
Right. Don't know if he had been a slave, if he was part of the clan, so to speak,
right.
How bright he was.
Yeah. The information that we have about him is in Genesis 15, if any of you want to read that at some point, if it is indeed Eliezer. Isn't it interesting along that line that we see again this person that seems like an outsider being in contact with God, speaking with God? You know, we saw that moment with Hagar yesterday where Hagar and God have this encounter. And so keeping in mind in all of these stories, this isn't just the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob story. There's a lot of players here. And I think that we are reducing the story when we keep calling it the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob story. It makes us hear it a certain way. It makes us skip over a ton of stuff. So.
Well, just one more thing that came to my mind about getting the, in terms of the prayer, she says, I'll get them the camel, blah, blah, blah. That also may have been not sort of like doing something bizarre, like if she, you know, shakes her left earlobe three times, but more of if she invites us in for coffee.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been the next step in hospitality naturally if she was a hospitable person.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't as a
superstitious
shot in the dark
or if she looks a certain way or if she but that they're talking about qualities that she would have. These are some qualities we're looking for.
Yeah, it just says he's there praying and doing this prayer, and she comes out. How do we know that she wasn't within earshot?
We don't.
And said, I'm ready to get out.
We don't. Right. And, you know, that's true of this entire story. I mean, it's true of every story, but particularly in this one. There's all kinds of, and that's why it's so easy to interpret one way or the other. If you're looking for a deceitful character, you can find a deceitful character, both in Rebecca and in her brother Laban, particularly. And if you're looking for a classic noble character, you can find that too in Rebecca. Laban, I'm not sure how you find that in Laban, but yeah, we don't know. We don't know, it's a possibility, yeah. What we know about wells. Wells are places that women go. Wells are places that young women go. Wells are places that are watering holes, if we want to use a modern term. Wells are pickup places.
It's the mall.
Oh, yeah. You know, they're not solely pickup places, but certainly if you're checking out who the young women of the community are, you go to the well. Which makes me wonder, you know, why Jesus was at the well in John 4. But we assume that was a ministry-related thing. Yeah. No, wells are places that were places that a lot of people met their wives. So, again, life-giving places, especially for those of you who have traveled to that part of the world and know how dry and arid and how precious water is.
We know that now.
We know that now. What we would give for a well right now.
Hey, Rebecca, in verse 20, so she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. I just thought about something. Isn't it Mark's gospel, the word immediately happens?
Yes.
You know, timing, you know, sometimes, you know, in the heat we move slowly, but she was moving quickly.
Quickly, and that's part of that active, you know, that we get this picture of Rebecca just jogging all over the place. Yeah, and immediately she did this, and you're right.
And I don't know how many camels, but it says until they have done drinking of camels.
Camels drink a lot of water. Yeah. So she was committing to herself to quite an act of caregiving.
Yeah, she was.
I think, just backing up for a second to his prayer, I think my first reaction was that it was one of these manipulative prayers, you know, do this, and then, you get this answer. But I think there are a couple things that suggest that's maybe not the case, that it's more the issue of, you know, this is the quality I'm looking for. I mean, one is this a comment at the end of the prayer, let her be the one whom you have
you
appointed.
You have appointed.
And then at the end of this passage, too, 21, he gazed at her in silence to learn whether or not God had made the journey successful. I mean, he's not jumping to the conclusion that this is it.
Exactly. Isn't that an interesting verse? A woman at the earlier study said that that's the moment that we may skip over a lot in our own prayer life, is that moment of pausing to consider, to almost reconsider the prayer. And again, is this God's intention? Does this fit with what I know God's intention to be? But she called that a contemplative, even meditative moment. That again would indicate him seeking to be part of what? Where did I write that? Do I have it up there today?
That was yesterday.
Oh, yesterday. Is that helpful? what is God's, you know, how does this, no, it's up there. What is, how is this action related to God's intention? I think you're right.
It's kind of like today where you make a call to somebody and say, push one if you'd like to review your prayer. Yeah. Push two if you'd like to redo your prayer. Three if you'd like to add to your prayer. Yeah.
Push four if you'd like to delete your prayer. Push five if this was not at all what you had in mind. Yeah. Okay, verse 22, enter the nose ring. So those of you with teenage kids can tune into this part. Let's do 22 to 33.
When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold nose ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? She said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. She added, we have plenty of straw and fodder and a place to spend the night. The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me on the way to the house of my master's kin. Then the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran out to the man to the spring. As soon as he had seen the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, and when he heard the words of his sister Rebekah, thus the man spoke to me. He went to the man, and there he was standing by the camels at the spring. He said, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside when I have prepared the house and a place for the camels?" So the man came into the house, and Laban unloaded the camels and gave him straw and fodder for the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Then the food was set before him to eat, but he said, "I will not eat until I have told my errand." He said, "Speak on."
We're introduced to the character of Laban, who will now be an important character in the story. Laban, what do you think about Laban in this story? What do you notice?
Well, are we to assume that Nahor has died and maybe Laban has sort of taken the place of...
Why is Laban in charge?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
She's
the daughter of Bethuel.
Yeah, it talks about the mother's household.
I know, that's always been confusing to me. That came up again this morning. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't even know where I would look to try to find out that information. But Laban is definitely the one who's, and we continue to see that in the rest of the chapter, the relationship between brother and sister. So another kind of relationship comes in here. How do you read him?
He seems anxious to cut the deal.
Okay.
He hears it and he's like, okay, don't, you know, come in and let's get going on the... Okay.
What does he notice?
Well,
he notices the jewelry, doesn't he? Now, that could mean one of several things. The two that I think of, one is that he knows that this is a marriage proposal and this is an important thing for Rebecca's well-being to tend to this. Or it could be that he knows that whoever is doing this has a lot of loot and that he can somehow access this. We don't know at this point what kind of character Laban is. More is revealed about him as the story goes on, particularly into the Rachel and Leah stories. Anything else that jumps out at you? Nose rings, they're scriptural. Can't fight them. I tell my confirmation kids that, just so that one of them can
but
go
they
home.
Were just the clip-on kind, right?
They were the clip-on kind. They were the clip-on kind. Pierced the nose ring. Not body piercing, just decorative jewelry. The next verse is 34. We're going to skip over 34 to...
50. Just say that's the good part.
I'll tell you why. We're going to offer a reason for you because it's Eliezer retelling the stuff we just read. So he's retelling all of that, and I want to make sure we get into chapter 25, which we didn't have time to this morning. So let's pick it up at 50 and see what happens here. Do you want me to read? Then Laban and Bethuel answered. The thing comes from the Lord, after Eliezer has explained all this. We cannot speak to you anything bad or good. Look, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. And the servant brought out jewelry of silver and of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave to her brother and to her mother costly ornaments. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there. When they rose in the morning, he said, "Send me back to my master." Her brother and her mother said, "Let the girl remain with us for a while, at least 10 days. After that, she may go." But he said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has made my journey successful. Let me go, that I may go to my master." They said, "We will call the girl and ask her." And they called Rebekah, and she said to her, "Will you go with this man?" She said, "I will." So they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse, along with Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of myriads. May your offspring gain possession of the gates of their foes." Then Rebekah and her maids rose up, mounted the camels, and followed the man. Thus the servant took Rebekah and went his way. What do you notice?
Yeah. Well, in a way, Rebekah has some choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaac, at this point, isn't even...
Isaac's
he has nothing to say about any of it.
No, he doesn't.
Abraham is sending his servant. Isaac isn't even involved. But Rebekah can say yes or no.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Isaac has no say in this. At this point, Rebekah does have a say. In fact, that's no small deal because this interaction is became the foundation for the rabbinic ruling that women cannot be married without their consent. What is cited in that is this story of Rebekah being asked her will. So this has quite a history that comes from it.
You know, what's interesting, when I read that, that's the same point that jumped out at me. And I guess this is the first time that I've really thought about the fact that probably every set of parents, I mean, there wasn't probably any more formula for child rearing then than there is today, although different sets of customs within the custom, you know, but that still some parents would probably be, you know, more given to having the child make choices or being dictatorial. So Rebekah's parents may have been much less autocratic and given her a few more choices and had let her have a say in it. And then you wonder if that's why she's actually a stronger woman all throughout her life, the fact that she was raised by parents who actually let her have a voice. And so she was stronger and more able to find a way to have herself heard than maybe some of the other women that were raised in more autocratic homes.
So you see some development, like child development almost going on here.
Parenting.
She
found her voice as a child because her parents let her have it, and she continued to have it throughout her life.
Mm, interesting, yeah.
This is probably colored by my... you know, what I know about Laban, in the future, but this story about Jacob, but, you know, I'm almost, you know, thinking he's trying to do the same thing. You know, let's keep Rebekah, you know, he's not going to let her go. Let's keep her 10 more days or so, and then we'll let her go. Maybe he's trying to get more out of this deal.
Yeah, it almost seems like foreshadowing, doesn't it? Laban is the dad who promises Jacob his daughter Rachel and then makes him work, then gives him Leah and makes him work for more years to get Rachel. I mean, Laban is not one that comes out of this story with a stellar character. So you're thinking he kind of makes the deal and then tries to go back on it a little bit, maybe giving him some time to get more out of this thing, and then, it's hard not to read him through that lens, but I mean, it's in the text. We're not making stuff up about him.
Yeah.
It's part of the story. Yeah.
It's interesting. Rebekah's ready, so she's not.
Which might fit with your comment back here that she was ready to get out of this locking town. Yeah.
Brother was like and wanted to go, and she didn't want to wait around that time
because
he was
going to
fret her, maybe have her, you know, do something else.
Yeah.
Mess her up a little bit.
Yeah, and when we know the rest of the story, we know that when Jacob needs to flee, she sends him to her brother Laban. So I don't know if it's because she knows that he's like Laban or what, but there's some relationship that continues between Rebekah and Laban.
Can I ask why in verse 50 Laban? Laban, and then you see Bethuel, however you say his, there. But then all of a sudden, he's not there again. And wait, is Bethuel a woman or a man?
Well, you know, Bethuel is Rebekah's...
Right.
Yeah, I am the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah.
So why is he gone all of a sudden? Then it reverts back to the son and the mom, the daughter, the brother and the mom again.
It is confusing. My guess, and I would need to look at some commentaries for this. This would be a moment to look at commentaries. Is that there's some weaving of stories going on here, And so you're right, because all of a sudden we're in the mother's household, and then there's the mother, which makes you think that the dad must not be there, but then all of a sudden the dad appears, and it's quite confusing. So that, I think that's a text thing we're dealing with there. That's my hunch. I would need to check that out.
But the 10 days to see if she's pregnant and they send a nurse with her?
Is that a hunch or?
Well, that's
oftentimes why there was a waiting period, although we've been so specifically told that she was a virgin.
Well, they spent the night.
Yeah. Oh, you mean that something happened there? Yeah, I don't know. I've never read that through kind of that pregnancy.
To see?
Yeah, I don't know. I had always read it more like, we were talking over here that Laban kind of wanted to milk the deal as far as he wanted.
Because
but that might be...
They said they'd spent the night. Usually they say, you know, they describe the act and they...
Right, because that
is... And it doesn't here.
No, and it doesn't. And it's also in the context of, then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and they spent the night there.
Right.
I kind of got more of the sense that they just kind of crashed there. Then that was...
But we don't know.
We don't know. We don't know. Yeah. You're right. Okay, are we ready? Let's finish 62 to the end, because this is where this reveals something about Isaac in this part. 62 to the end of the chapter.
Now, Isaac had come from Beer Lahairoi and was settled in the Negev. Isaac went out in the evening to walk in the field, and looking up, he saw camels coming. And Rebekah looked up, and when she saw Isaac, she slipped quickly from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is the man over there walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death.
Didn't take that long.
Yeah.
They know each other.
Yeah, that's. We're certainly aware that we're reading this cross-culturally, aren't we? When we hear that.
Is this the first reference to love?
Love. It's the first of this kind.
Yeah.
That he loved her. But after she was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not our notion of romantic love that leads to marriage, certainly.
Well, and also the way the text reads, the consummation took place before the marriage, right? Or we don't know.
Where
the consummation is the marriage.
Right. Yeah. So they're married at that point. Yeah, we're not told anything about any ceremonial kind of action, are we? Isaac is quite connected to his mother, isn't he? There's a man at the earlier study was reflecting on that strong connection that often seems to be in the Middle East between mother and son, culturally.
My translation says that in verse 63 that Isaac went into the field because he wanted to spend some time thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Anthony brought up this morning I hadn't. I thought of Isaac as somebody that really loved his wife and was a more gentle person, was blind at the end of the field and stuff. But I think that's it. And probably because I'm reading from my children's Bible, my child's Bible that I brought for her and then forgot my own. That I'm thinking about my kids reading that, and that's a really a neat thing for them to read, that's a value that you go somewhere to think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a tender scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
That scene. What qualities are revealed about Rebecca in that scene? How is she taking shape in your mind? Dresner, the man who wrote the book I recommended, Rachel, that's in the bookstore, talks about Rebecca's modesty,
mm-hmm,
that is revealed in this scene. Again, that's an interpretation of her behavior. Covering the veil, not wanting to get off the camels in the presence of Isaac. Covering herself with her veil. So he has a very charitable reading of Rebecca.
But yeah, she still did ask, who is the man? And she still did, you know, slip down and approach him, didn't she?
Yes. She asked about him. She notices him. Right? Again.
She's smart.
All those things. She's not a dim bulb. No. All those things that that make her an active character. You get this sense. She's the one that's noticing. She's assertive. I guess that's the word. She is. Yeah. Well, let's go into 25. We're going to skip the first part of the chapter. I'll tell you why. It's a genealogy. It would be good to read. It tells you what happens with Abraham.
Isaac came from the same well that Hagar named.
Yeah. Did you notice that connection? Yeah. Yep, exactly. The well that still exists over there. Yeah. Let's pick up in 25:19. And this sets the stage for a lot of the more famous activity that we know. Does somebody want to read 19 through 26 for us?
These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean.
Aramean.
Mm-hmm. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted this prayer. And his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is to be this way, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." How far?
To 26.
When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy mantle, so they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them.
Okay, what do we learn here? Oh, this is rich.
So 20
stuff.
Years to have kids.
20 years to have kids, which still might make Rebecca about my age. Isn't that amazing? I mean, she could have been very young when she got married. Yeah. But again, that view of the threat of barrenness.
And then the barrenness and then the younger son, well, eventually receiving the blessing.
Yeah, the younger son is the one who ends up with it. We see a relationship between Isaac and the Lord here. Isaac prayed for his wife, so Isaac is lifted up just in that simple sentence as one of faith, one who has a relationship with God. Have any of you that have been pregnant ever felt that way? If it is to be this way, why do I live? The struggling that went on, imagine what they didn't know about the process of pregnancy and childbirth, and you know, she hadn't gone and gotten an ultrasound and knew that she was having twins, you know. But something was going on. What I find really amazing about this that shapes the whole story is pivotal to understanding Rebecca and her character. She receives this revelation. She's the one that receives the revelation about Jacob. God says to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples born of you shall be divided. One will be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." She's the one with this information, right? So the decisions that she makes about Esau and Jacob are made with this information. And so for a woman to be the receiver of the information, we saw in the generation before where Sarah was in the dark, clear till she literally overheard the information that this was about her. Rebecca gets this information and she acts on it. You know, on a personal note, I used to ask my father, who was a Lutheran pastor, when I first was getting to know this story in Sunday school, and the one you always learn about her helping Jacob cheat, you know, why did you name me after her? And my dad would say, because she knew God's will and she carried it out. And I never knew what that meant.
But she's the one with the information. The older one will serve the younger one. And so in some ways her cheating, and maybe this, maybe I go to great lengths to put a spin on Rebecca that's charitable, but she, because she goes to great lengths to carry this out and to listen to what has been told her. Now, we're also told, if you read just a bit on, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So that's, I think, where we enter into that idea of favoritism, and that Rebekah's actions were only based on her favoritism of Jacob. And that's probably a fair reading as well. But we're skipping over the fact that she has received this revelation from God of what is to happen. She doesn't argue with God, does she? Well, that doesn't make any sense. The oldest one should be the one. I mean, she doesn't know these kids when she's pregnant with them.
So. Well, like you said, she went to inquire of the Lord, not to ask or to pray, but to inquire.
To inquire. Yeah. Any other thing from that section? The names are important, aren't they? We're spending some time noticing names.
First of all, you know, the voice, we've talked a lot, Rebekah has a voice. She speaks, she consents, she does all these things. The names of the twins, Esau, Red, that's what the closest word we can think of, Hairy.
That wasn't that our brother's favorite verse in the Bible, is Esau was a hairy man. Go figure, I don't know what that says about him. But Jacob, the word Jacob, Yahav, it means supplants, or really literally means heel grabber. But one who supplants, one who is often translated cheats, one who makes a way for himself, you know, grabbing on. What does that image conjure up in your head if the second one being born is grabbing on to the twin in front of them? Sort of me first, I'm yanking you back in so I can go out.
Or I want to go with you. Hey,
maybe.
I'll go where you're going to go. Let's make trouble together.
Whither thou goest, I shall go. That's what you're in. Now, if the word Jacob meant, whither thou goest, I shall go, then we would know you were right. Since it means supplanter, cheater, deceiver, heel grabber, then we're kind of told right from the beginning what their fate is going to be.
You know, what's interesting about the names, just quickly, is that Esau is the hunter. And you think of a hunter being more of an aggressive thing to do. And Jacob, it was a quiet man dwelling among the tents. And yet Jacob was the one that was grabbing onto the heel and cheating the brother out of his birthright and so forth. So kind of my notion of those behaviors is,
inconsistent. That the one who would be the more aggressive hunter would be the more maybe deceitful, cunning, conniving one.
Jacob is the thinker.
Jacob's a thinker.
Maybe
somebody called him a mama's boy. Jacob was a mama's boy.
Well, there's a little bit of ambiguity then in that line, in verse 23. You know, the one shall be stronger than the other. Well, which one is stronger than which one, and in what way?
And what is strength?
Right.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That really brings that question up: is Esau the stronger one, or is Jacob the stronger one? Yeah, that's really interesting.
We assume that because the older son will serve the younger son, that the older son is less strong, but you're not told.
Yeah.
Those sentences don't necessarily, and he will be the one that serves us. We're not told it that way. That's right.
We've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to say a couple things setting up our story for tomorrow. I really want to be able to honor the schedule we set up in finishing up Friday with a very different story of women of Genesis. I think we're going to need to modify it a little bit. The Rachel and Leah story is epic, and it's
beautiful and it's valuable and we need to spend time with it tomorrow. We may need to spend a little bit of time Friday. So I think what I'll say is that by Friday we'll get to Dinah. I'm not sure we'll do Tamar, but we'll at least look at Dinah so that we can try to factor in more of that type of story. But now when you go forward, if you have any time to read tonight and want to start in chapter 29, notice the detail. Notice the Rachel becomes her legacy to the Jewish people is unsurpassed. And she becomes one of the primary figures that's represented in art throughout. If any of you have seen any of Marc Chagall's work, in fact, I think it's his work on the front of this book. That's Rachel and Jacob meeting at the well. It also is the story of them meeting is a pivotal point in Jacob's character continuing to be revealed. It also, we enter the dynamic of sisterhood. Rachel and Leah are probably, we don't often get sisters in the Bible that we know anything about. We have Mary and Martha in the New Testament. Rachel and Leah stand in the Old Testament as a story of sisterhood. But it also is the first, and as far as I know, only story in the Bible that has this notion of romantic love in the whole, you know, running through the daisies to embrace somebody and kiss them is in this story. So that's why I like it. That's where you spend a lot of time on that moment. So if you get a chance to look forward, yes, we'll be speaking in slow motion. No. It really is quite a tale, and it sets up, you know, Jacob becomes Israel, and he's a pivotal character, as are Rachel and Leah. So, thank you for your attention. Enjoy your day. Get some. Don't drink water. Enjoy your day.